Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Oh, I hope you have your dancing shoes on, because we will be, as they say, bringing the noise and bringing the funk. We have live music from the Budos Band, a brass-heavy party group out of Staten Island that blends James Brown funk with East and West African sounds. And we'll return to our How to Be Smarter series to learn about DJ Mustard, who's produced many of the biggest hip-hop party songs of the past 3 years. But if we're going to talk about funk and groove into the music, we got to start right at the source.
Introducing the King of Soul, recently has been crowned as one of the hardest working entertainers in the world. The living legend, the fantastic Mr. Dynamite, James Brown.
James Brown was Mr. Dynamite, the hardest working man in show business, and many other less broadcastable names. To tell the story of how he got to be such a pivotal figure in American culture, you better bring your A-team. The new documentary, Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown, was produced by Mick Jagger and directed by the Oscar-winning, Emmy-winning Alex Gibney. The film airs on HBO on October 27th, and Alex Gibney returns to our Soundcheck studio today. Alex, welcome back.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
So a lot of your documentaries, I mean, the Enron documentary, Casino Jack, especially Taxi to the Dark Side, they kind of shine a light on topics, on stories that, you know, were perhaps intentionally kept dark.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you've got a guy who had the spotlight from, like, day one. Did this feel like a different kind of approach for you?
It was. I mean, everybody knows who James Brown is. But I think the impetus here was going back and looking at a couple of things, not that people missed, really, but that maybe had been overlooked to some extent. And one was his, you know, the film's really about how he changed the culture.
Mm.
And he changed the culture with his music, to be sure. But we give voice to a lot of the musicians in the film that a lot of people don't know about. The band. He was the great band leader, but you don't know that much about the band. The other thing was he changed the culture in a lot of ways in terms of how he threw, in his own way, threw his shoulder behind the civil rights movement in a very different way than Martin Luther King or Stokely Carmichael. But from a cultural perspective, he added force to it in a way that brought it into the culture.
Right.
And so that was interesting. I hadn't, you know, before I started this, I didn't really know that much about that side of him.
So what was the impetus for you to go down this route in the first place?
Well, the impetus was I got a call from Mick Jagger. Would you like to do a film about James Brown? It's like
he probably doesn't get a lot of no's when he makes phone calls, does he?
No, and particularly when he says, "How'd you like to do a film about James Brown?" It's like, okay, one, two, you know, yes, yes was the answer. It didn't take long to figure that one out.
Well, now Jagger is clearly, you know, he has studied James Brown.
Right.
He produced the biopic about James Brown in addition to this documentary. And in your film, he actually has something pretty perceptive to say about James Brown and who he studied. Listen to this. This is from the forthcoming movie Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown.
He liked big bands. He liked a big horn section. And he liked instrumentals. He liked arranging. He liked to be a band leader. Carried some of that past of the swing era in a funny way.
Now that is something, Alex, that I hadn't thought of before. James Brown, the godfather of funk, as somebody looking back to the big band swing era.
Yeah, he's Duke Ellington. And that was an insight. I mean, I didn't really think of that either when I started this project. But what an insight, because you understand what he's taking from the past and how he takes that and pushes it into the future. But, yeah, he loved being on stage, kind of. And it got to that point, too, where also all the musicians were on him as a performer. So he would do what the band called these hits. Mm. Like, he would always motion in a certain way, and the drummers were supposed to pick up on that moment, and they had to keep their eyes on him. But actually, we found this little clip of Duke Ellington as the band leader. He's doing the hits back then, too. So it was really fun to see how he pulled back from the past and then moved into the future.
Mm. The film, the documentary, is Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown, directed by Alex Gibney, who's with me here on Soundcheck. There is some astonishing early footage from James Brown before he was James Brown. I mean, where did that come from?
You're talking about the black and white footage?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's from the Olympia in Paris. And I believe that's 66 and 67. So it's early. And it's riveting because that's the footage in which you can see him as the kind of the band leader. And, and it's kind of that transitional moment because he's got Maceo Parker on saxophone. You know, he's pulling from jazz. You don't think about jazz when you're thinking about James Brown, but really that's where he's pulling from. And he's got this. And then he's got this kind of rhythmic dance section. And then he had the women.
Right.
So it comes out of sort of vaudeville and those acts that they used to do at the Apollo Theater. That's the other thing that Mick Jagger talks about a little bit, where they'd roll out a number of comedy acts, you know, all sorts of wild stuff that would be, you know, you'd think of as being part of the routine.
And you think of James Brown and that fantastic scream, and you've sort of dug into the roots of where that came from. He played Little Richard for 2 weeks.
Who knew that? I mean, the idea that he actually literally, because TV wasn't that big, and you didn't see that many feature, you know, you didn't see feature documentaries. Nobody knew exactly what Little Richard looked like. So he literally was Little Richard. When Little Richard had to, you know, go off to L.A., there were a whole bunch of dates that had to be fulfilled, and James Brown was Little Richard.
So he was a Little Richard impersonator
to start
his career. And then, now, people talk about the Beatles on Ed Sullivan as a landmark moment. They talk about James Brown at the Apollo as a landmark moment. What about James Brown on Ed Sullivan?
James Brown on Ed Sullivan was a huge moment. And suddenly, this wild character who many people had seen through the Chitlin Circuit, and especially at the Apollo Theater, you know, sort of the culmination of the Chitlin Circuit, now they were seeing on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was the purveyor of the broadest possible sense of what was alive in culture at that moment. So it was this African-American world coming into a predominantly white environment that was spectacular.
This is a moment from Alex Gibney's film, Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown.
Now, understand that when black artists would come on Ed Sullivan, they would usually come on and perform with Ed Sullivan's house band, who were excellent musicians, but you got no soul out of them at all. James Brown made it clear he was coming on one way and one way only, and that was with his full bands. So you were going to see the James Brown Show.
Late great James Brown on the Ed Sullivan Show from the film Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown. It airs on HBO on October 27th, produced by Mick Jagger and directed by Alex Gibney, the Oscar-winning and multiple Emmy-winning director and my guest on Soundcheck today. This clip, as several others in the film do, ends with this magnificent shot of an apparently exhausted James Brown being escorted from the stage with a cape wrapped around his shoulder. The idea that he just gave so much.
Well, as Mick Jagger said, I mean, they worked that into the routine, particularly with his song Please, 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 where Danny Ray and sometimes Maceo Parker would drape this cape over Mr. Brown. And the idea was you had to protect him from himself. He was putting so much into the show that you had to put the blanket over him, put the cape over him, and lead him off. And then he would throw the cape off and come back and do it one more time.
It's great showbiz, and it's visual gold for a documentary maker like you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, this documentary focuses essentially on the first 20 years or so of his career. And as you said before, sort of a dual path, the music and the social impact.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the music for a moment. First of all, were you a fan? Did you grow up a James Brown
fan?
Yeah,
I was a fan, but I can't say that I was like a super fan. I mean, just going into something like this, one of the reasons I wanted to go into it was to really dig deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often the fun of these projects for me.
Now, you said that, you know, what interested you was the idea that there were things maybe that people didn't miss, but they didn't understand the importance of. And one of those is the song Cold Sweat.
Yeah.
What is the significance of Cold Sweat?
It's the first funk song. I mean, it takes us into a whole new era. And so we were able to break that song down, particularly with the help of Pee Wee Ellis, who was the band leader of that time, who was just, and also you hear in Cold Sweat, you know, that he's pulling from all sorts of different places, from some very funky places, from cool jazz, from Miles Davis. I mean, and it all comes from the impetus of James Brown wanting something but not quite being able to articulate it.
So he goes to Pee Wee Ellis, or he has Pee Wee Ellis come to him and says, I'm hearing this thing. Can you write that down? And Pee Wee Ellis goes and writes it down.
So I started putting notation to his grunts. It just came out of the bass line to Cold Sweat.
I don't care!
I've been listening to Miles Davis, and So What popped up in my head. So I took the part and just repeated it over and over, and then we added a very important guitar part, contrasting all of that, which is funky by itself.
From the film Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown by director Alex Gibney, you hear Pee Wee Ellis recounting how James Brown and Pee Wee sort of collectively put together this song, Alex. And the idea that Pee Wee Ellis is, in a way, sampling Miles Davis.
Right. That's exactly right. He's sampling Miles Davis and putting it into this new song, which becomes funk. And they didn't have, as Pee Wee says later, I mean, he didn't have any idea how big or influential this would be. They were just looking for something. And Mr. Brown, you know, heard something, but he couldn't quite articulate it. And that's where he goes to people like Pee Wee to try to make it happen for him.
Now, you know, James Brown, of course, would go on to become one of the most heavily sampled artists in hip-hop history, and especially his drummer, Clyde Stubblefield. You think he would have appreciated the irony if someone had pointed out to him, well, you know, your career is built on samples of other people's stuff?
I don't think Mr. Brown appreciated irony very much. That was not his thing. He was much more straight ahead.
Yeah. All right, so music is one thing, but the social impact as well. Somebody in the film refers to him as a civil rights movement of one. Might be Reverend Al Sharpton, might be someone else, but didn't he walk a fine line? Because he didn't want to be perceived as a quote-unquote race artist.
No, he didn't. He wanted to have a broad audience, the broadest possible audience. But at the same time, you know, he talked a lot about soul and soul power. And for him, soul, you know, he defines it earlier in the film where he said, soul is all about the word can't, by which he meant, you know, it's what people say you can't do because you're black. And if you internalize it, you realize you can do what they say you can't do. And for him, that's what it was all about. It was all about having a landscape in which you as an individual could do whatever you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in some ways, you know, he diverged from a lot of the civil rights figures in the sense that – he didn't see the kind of systemic problems that were keeping people down. For him, it was all about individual empowerment. But wherever he saw, you know, obstacles in the way of individual empowerment, he fought hard to break them down.
And in the wake of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, there's a remarkable scene in the film where he goes ahead with a show in Boston, and the audience is in an uproar. And they're rushing the stage, and the Boston police are confronting, you know, these young black people who've rushed up on stage with James Brown. And in one of the most memorable moments in the film, Mr. Dynamite, James Brown calms the unruly crowd.
I didn't know what to say about that myself. I'm sitting there on the drum still just waiting, you know, like, wow, what's going on?
This is no way. We are black. We are black. Now, wait a minute. Can't y'all go back down and let's do the show together? We're black. Don't make us all look bad. Let me finish doing the show. Come off the stage. Set on the show. Let's represent our own selves. Now, step down. No, no, that's not right. You're not being fair to yourself and me either. You're not being fair to yourself and me either, or your race. Now, I asked the police to step back because I figured I could get some respect for my own people. That makes sense. And are we together, Wayne? Hit the thing, man.
And the show goes on. I mean, Alex, he's like preaching to the choir there.
It's unbelievable. It's a church moment, no doubt. And also, you can see it. I mean, in the footage, you can see how badly wrong it could have gone. Because when those kids start racing the stage, big, burly, white Boston cops start tossing them off the stage.
Yeah.
And Mr. Brown says, no, 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 don't be doing that here. We're fine.
Right.
You know, and he gets the cops to back off. Which was, that's the moment.
Yeah. And, you know, I get chills just thinking about, you know, and he says, look, I asked these cops to stop because I think I can get some respect from my own people.
That's
and,
right.
You know, when he asks, are you with me and are you not? And you hear that roar from the crowd that literally 60 seconds ago was up in arms.
Right.
It's amazing. The film is called Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown by Alex Gibney, my guest on Soundcheck today. It airs on HBO on October 27th. And then, of course, he goes on to write I'm Black and I'm Proud, which Reverend Al Sharpton in the film says this song, and I'll quote, literally changed the social dynamic of the United States. Now, James Brown's career is full of watershed moments. Where does this one rank?
This one is huge because, you know, I talked earlier about how interested I was in how he changed the culture. This was a moment where he literally changes the culture. I'm black and I'm proud. You know, it's not about somebody, you guys, you know, you white culture should give us something. It's like, as he says later, open up the door, I'll get it myself. You know, I'm black and I'm proud. I'm not going to be put down at all by the fact that I'm, you know, a different color. It's hugely powerful, and Reverend Sharpton even talks about how it changed things internally in the black community, that sometimes for lighter-skinned blacks, you know, who had, in some cases, achieved a kind of privileged position, and even Mr. Brown saw that earlier on, where he had a harder time coming up, you know, because some of the lighter-skinned black entertainers seemed to have a, you know, an easier time of it. Well, suddenly I'm black and I'm proud. Suddenly everybody's saying, whoa, that really dark black woman, she is hot. And everything changes.
Right. Now, is this a film that couldn't have been made while James Brown was alive? Would you have found it difficult to get people to speak as freely as they do in the making of this movie?
I think that's true. I think that's true. And I think even in this film, there was a reticence. There were a couple of people with whom I had to go back a second time to get them to talk because, you know, he was a complicated character. He was tormented by demons, and a lot of that came out in very violent ways, both with his band and also with a lot of his female companions. And I think a lot of those demons drove his art, but also compromised who he was as a human being. And I think that that aspect and the willingness to speak honestly about it wouldn't have happened while he was alive, because also people at the same time, and it's an apparent contradiction or maybe a paradox, a lot of these musicians felt that it was super important to recognize how powerful a musical figure he was, and nobody wanted that to be undermined.
Right, right.
So it's the ability now, after the fact, after he's died, to be able to hold them both in your hands and say, yes, he was a flawed human being, and yes, he was a tremendous artist.
And we do, fortunately, still have most of these band members, you know, available to us to talk. I'll mention one more bit from the film. Perhaps the most amazing sequence is Melvin Parker talking about pulling a gun on James Brown. You ever come for me and my brother, Maceo, you know, I'm going to use this. And the look on his face, it's like, oh, my God, he clearly meant it.
Yeah.
So James Brown, someone who could inspire both, you know, this great loyalty that you're talking about, at the same time that people really kind of hated his guts.
Well, the band members, you know, always felt mistreated. You know, there were a number of times where they quit on him. He treated them very badly. Even as he, you know, sort of revered them for their musical ability, you know, on the road, he sometimes they would get paid, sometimes they wouldn't, sometimes they'd be left in a town without any way to get back. So the only way really to protect against that was to stand up for yourself. And ironically, James Brown always respected that. If you kind of, you know, dug in your heels and stood up to him, he would sometimes back down.
All right, so this film, as we said, charts the rise of James Brown, about the first 20 years of his career. Things take a much darker turn later on. Will there be a second film that will maybe look at some of the ups and downs of the later years?
Maybe. That would be an interesting film in and of itself. I think we, you know, on this film, we felt there was so much to talk about that it was enough to take it this far. And we jump forward, I should say, in time to deal with his influence on the hip-hop era. But in terms of his own life, that second half of his life, it's more of a character study and probably deserves its own film.
Well, this film is called Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown. It airs on HBO on October 27th. Alex Gibney, the director. Alex, great to see you again. Nice job.
Thanks, John.
Say it loud.
Up next, we learn more about a mysterious underground producer named Dijon McFarlane, who goes by the name DJ Mustard. He scored 19 Hot 100 hits in the past 3 years, and he's the subject of the latest installment in our How to Be Smarter series. And later, the Budos Band from Staten Island plays live. All of that coming up on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Take a listen to this.
What's that on that beat?
All right, here it is again.
What's that on that beat?
Now, if you've listened to any pop or mainstream rap radio in the past year, odds are you've heard that tag at the beginning of a song hundreds of times. If you're like me, though, you never really understood exactly what the guy's saying. Turns out that's the calling card of a producer by the name of Dijon McFarlane, otherwise known, inevitably, as DJ Mustard. Dijon Mustard, get it? He's saying Mustard on the beat, and he's saying it to the tune of 19 different Billboard Hot 100 hits over the past 3 years. For the next installment in our How to Be Smarter series, we've called upon Soumya Krishnamurthy to tell us a little bit more about who DJ Mustard is and why he's on so many songs these days. Soumya writes about hip-hop for Billboard, Rolling Stone, Village Voice, and Vibe. Soumya, welcome back to Soundcheck.
How are you?
Good. So DJ Mustard, Mustard on the beat.
Mustard on the beat ho, actually. We had to censor it, you know, for our purposes. But that's actually what his name check is.
Where is this guy from?
He's from California. So Mustard has been instrumental in really bringing back this California rap sound.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for him, he started sort of in the Jerk movement in the 2000s, which was a very short-lived California movement. But, you know, it was really symbolized by party music. You know, mm-hmm. he's a guy who did the house party scene, and one of his flagship artists, probably his biggest artist that he really kind of takes ownership of, is YG. And together they just created this party sound, and it really swept the nation after Tyga's Rack City, which, you know, took on a life of its own inside the strip club and outside of the strip club, and now everyone wants a piece of Mustard.
So DJ Mustard is on so many songs that we were able to put together a little montage here of openings of songs by YG and Chris Brown and Ty Dolla Sign and a whole bunch of others. And as you listen to this, I think you will hear certain similarities.
Certain ingredients, so to speak.
Okay. All right, in order of appearance, Jeremiah and YG, Don't Tell Him, Ty Dolla Sign featuring B.O.B., Paranoid, Kid Ink and Chris Brown with Show Me, YG again with Jeezy and Rich Homie Quan with My Hitta, and then Tinashe and Schoolboy Q with Two On, all produced by DJ Mustard. So, Soumya, what are the kind of basic building blocks of the Mustard sound?
We definitely heard a lot of different songs, but they could all have been looped into one continuous song. So really, aside from his name check, right, that Mustard on the beat, it's a lot of sparse drums, very synthy, and you do hear a lot of signature claps. So it's one of those things where very quickly into a song, you know whether it's a Mustard beat or not a Mustard beat. And, you know, it's a blessing and a curse because a lot of people think it's great that the minute you turn on a song on the radio, you know who that producer is, whether you heard the name check or not. And that's very powerful. It's almost like a calling card. But the flip side is, do you then become sort of a one-trick pony and all you can do is a certain sound? And that's sort of what people have with Mustard right now, where everyone wants that one sound, but is that going to sort of be his downfall as well?
But in the short term, it must be great because...
Oh, being DJ Mustard is great right now. You know, it's funny because I think in hip-hop, every year or two, we have sort of these hot producers, right? So it's happened since time immemorial with Pharrell and Timbaland, and now guys like Mike Will Made It, and, you know, now Mustard, where you produce one or two hits that have this great sound. They've proven themselves in the clubs, on the charts, and everyone wants a piece, and they literally come to these producers and say, give me another Rack City, give me another My Hitta. And for a producer, that, you know, puts them in a very good place. So I think that's where artists right now, when they want a hit, it doesn't matter if you're J-Lo, Fergie, pop, hip-hop, it really doesn't matter. Everyone wants a Mustard track.
And it sounds like they're not only, you know, kind of using the same arsenal of synthesizer sounds and the calling card, but there's also a kind of rhythmic similarity as well, which must play really well in the clubs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, you can really picture whether you're at an L.A. house party or sitting in a studio with you, John, it feels like we're in an L.A. house party. And anytime you hear that song or even those beats, you just want to dance. You want to, you know, start moving. And it's very powerful. And no matter what, people like party music. People want to have fun. And I think that's been hugely a factor of propelling Mustard.
All right. Now, you've mentioned Rack City twice. What's the significance of this song by Tyga?
So Rack City was not only Tyga's biggest hit, but also just really a phenomenon when it came to a hip-hop song. And obviously the racks that he's talking about are racks that you take to the strip club and throw at the strippers, so to speak. And, you know, it's a song that I think intentionally was made or initially was made for the strip clubs, but it just turned into this larger cultural movement where now everyone from soccer moms to, you know, 80-year-olds were making it rain, so to speak, and using that terminology. And that kind of became sort of a signature for the strip club anthem is Rap City.
And it's a DJ Mustard production.
It is a DJ Mustard production.
Let's hear a little.
Rack City chick, rack City chick. 10, 20s and them 50s chick. 100 deep VIP, no guest list. TT Raw, you don't know who you with. Got my other chick, hugging on my other chick. Hugging all night, nigga, we ain't sell a bit. Tap tap, too dope, I ain't selling it. Bar fresher than them peppermint. Go let him in, his last game killing it. Young money, yeah, we getting rich. Get your grandma on my girl, you know what it is. Rack City chick. Rack City chick. Rack City chick. 10, 20s, and a 50s chick.
So did you not feel that you were at a strip club for those 5 seconds? I mean, you were dancing. If we had singles, we'd be throwing them at each other, you know. Let's just say that you are red right now, so you are blushing a little bit. So I think the song did what it was supposed to do.
Well, you know, you said before that he might be, again, we're talking about DJ Mustard, who produced that track, Rack City, for Tyga, that he might turn out to be a one-trick pony. It sounds like there are a couple of tricks. He might be a three-trick pony. There's the calling card, Mustard on the beat. There's this kind of minimalist synth thing that he does on all of the songs. And then almost every song that he has produced has that little off-the-beat, hey, you know, hey, hey.
Tell him, don't tell him, don't tell him. You ain't need, don't tell him, don't tell him. You ain't even gotta tell him, don't tell him, don't tell him.
So, I mean, it sounds like the exact same sample on every song.
And it's funny because a lot of his detractors, that's exactly what he says, where it's come to a point where, you know, is he just, you know, handing out beats that, you know, like the way he changes socks is him handing out different songs to artists. But it's a hit, you know, as much as we can say that a lot of the songs do sound very similar, and we're not sure what that creative process is. He actually tailoring them to the artist? Does he just have a MacBook full of beats and he copies and pastes and sends it to people? We don't know, but people still crave that sound. I mean, he's taken over the Billboard charts, and as of right now, you know, he really is probably one of the biggest producers of the year.
And it is, I mean, you mentioned Timbaland before, whose productions could be very kind of sophisticated and multi-layered. This is like completely stripped down.
Yes, this is very much production 101, which I think, again, some of the detractors feel like, so what exactly is he doing? Why is he getting paid all this money and getting all these accolades? And why are we talking about him? But, you know, the flip side is sometimes there's beauty in simplicity.
Sure.
You know, just keep it simple, dummy. Like, we want to dance. We want to have a good time. And you don't need to make it so multi-layered and have a live orchestra. You know, this isn't Hans Zimmer. It's DJ Mustard. And it gets the job done.
So who are his predecessors? Who is he kind of, what scene is he kind of coming out of?
You know, he's coming out of this LA scene, which, you know, it's funny, for a long time in mainstream hip hop, many people like saw it very dormant, in fact, you know, that they were sort of doing their own thing and, you know, the South was just running it, right? Mm-hmm. So everyone, Lex Luger, Mike Will, like those were the guys who were really running with it. But, you know, in the last few years, that LA scene with you know, not just with Mustard, but with YG, I think, specifically, and then also to a large extent, Kendrick Lamar, Schoolboy Q, just expanding
Odd
to
Future.
That whole, exactly, yeah. It really has, you know, taken over. But, you know, when it comes to him, that he's really kind of in his league of his own right now.
So does he name check, you know, Dre or any of the other old school producers? Does he say, you know, I'm not just like some guy with, you know, with GarageBand. I've studied these guys.
Yeah, I think he uses Fruity Loops from what I've heard. But, you know, I think anyone, you know, I mean, every producer obviously looks at Dre as kind of the prototype. And I know Mustard has in the past, you know, paid homage to Dre because really he was and, you know, maybe is still the biggest rap producer out of the West Coast is Dr. Dre. So I think we're all students of Dre for sure.
We're speaking with Soumya Krishnamurthy about the hip-hop producer DJ Mustard, who is all over the Billboard Hot 100, 7 songs currently on the Billboard chart that he has produced. And over the last 3 years, 19 different Hot 100 hits. We've talked about, you know, songs like Rack City that are kind of, you know, calling cards, emblematic for him. Are there must-to-avoids with DJ Mustard?
Well, you know, it's funny because sometimes when something is so good and everyone wants it, it sort of loses its, you know, cachet. And certain artists, I think, just don't fare too well sonically with his sound. And, you know, some recent examples I can think of is, I know Fergie, her new song, she's collaborated with him. LA got the people saying, la, 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 la. Brooklyn saying, la, 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 la. And Jennifer Lopez also not too long ago had a song with DJ Mustard. At the end of the night. I think it just might be their vocal style coming in as more pop singers. You know, it would probably just doesn't fit with him, you know, and it's one of those things. Everything ain't for everybody. But unfortunately, right now, everyone wants a taste of mustard, whether they should
nice.
Be or not. You know, you like that, right? That was nice.
So do you think a couple of years from now, we'll still be talking about DJ Mustard, or, you know, will it turn out to be the sound of a specific era and period at the end of the sentence?
You know, it's really up to him. If he's able to push past this one sound and shows that he has other kind of, you know, tricks in his MacBook and he has other things he can do, then I think there's really no stopping him. But, you know, that's sort of what it is for every producer. You know, there were times we were talking about Lex Luger. There were times we were talking about, you know, Southside, like people who were huge for a while. They really created a sound, and then it's like, so where did they go again? But it's really up to him. You know, he's young. I don't think we mentioned he's only 24 years old. I mean, can the kid even rent a car by himself? Probably not. So, you know, when he can rent a car by himself and he shows that he has a bunch of other sounds in his arsenal, I would love to see him collaborate beyond rap. You know, I think YG and Mustard is a great fit together, you know, but I would love to see what can he do outside of his comfort zone, and just really push beyond, you know, if you took a Mustard track, took out the name check, took out some of these sonic signatures, would we still be talking about it? And I think if he's able to do that, then he shows that he has longevity.
Well, for the moment, he is all up and down the Billboard Hot 100 is DJ Mustard, a.k.a. Dijon McFarlane. And this has been part of our How to Be Smarter series, How to Be Smarter About DJ Mustard. Thanks, Soumya Krishnamurthy. Great to see you again.
Always. See you at the next party.
When you see us shining, it's because we steady grinding. We stay paper chasing.
Up next, the Budos Band brings its full frontal Afro-funk to the studio. We'll get a taste of their bewitching new record, Burnt Offering, and hopefully they don't peel all the paint off our walls in the process. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Based in Staten Island, the Budos Band is a motley crew of musicians ranging in size from 6 to 13 members. They've been together, more or less, for 15 years, producing a high-energy blend of Afro-soul, psychedelia, and occasional touches of metal. It's been 4 years since the last Budos Band album, but they are back now, with a somewhat darker, grungier sound than ever before. The Budos Band joins us today in the Soundcheck studio to play some songs from their new album called Burnt Offering, and they're here to start us off with a song called Magus Mountain. This is the Budos Band. We'll be right back. That's the Budos Band live on Soundcheck with a song called Magus Mountain. You'll find it on the new Budos Band album called Burnt Offering. And the members of the band here in our studio, Tom Brennick on guitar, Dan Fodor on bass, Michael Deller playing the Farfisa organ, Andrew Green on trumpet, and joining me at the microphone, Jared Tankel on baritone sax. Hi, Jared.
Hi, John.
And Brian Profilio behind our drum kit. Hey, Brian.
Nice to meet you, John.
So tell me about this. A lot of the earlier Budos Band records, I'll address this question to you, Jared, because you're one of the horn players. It had a kind of a horn-heavy, Fela Kuti, Ethiopian jazz sound.
Yeah.
There's still some of that on some tracks here, but it seems like maybe you've moved a step away from that on this new record.
Yeah, I mean, I think all along as a band, we've always enjoyed listening to, individually and collectively, you know, heavy rock, hard rock, metal from the 70s in particular. This time around on this album, I think in its most fullest form, we've been able to incorporate that into our sound as a band.
Brian, the name Budos, where did that come from?
When we first started off as the Afrobeat band, we used the name Los Barbudos, which is the bearded ones in Spanish. And it was you know, kind of just like a funny thing. We didn't think anything of it. It was like, oh, yeah, we all have beards. We'll call ourselves Los Barbudos. But there was a political, you know, back end that we didn't really look into. It was Castro's, like, rebel army.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No. So, and his baseball team. When he took over in 55, he had a baseball team called Los Barbudos, and he was a pitcher, too. He was terrible.
Well, I know he was a huge baseball fan. I mean, I think that's pretty well known, but that he had his own team, and that's the name
of it.
Yeah,
there's a photo of his team. Okay. You know, but we had to change it because it was too much political.
So from Barbudos just to plain old
the Budos. The Budos Band, yeah.
The Budos Band. And you guys have been together now for about 15 years, right?
Some of us have been playing together for 15 years, but I think as the Budos Band, it's more like closer to 10.
Yeah. And over that time, you know, as Jared was saying, you know, we've heard the influence of Ethiopian music, of Fela Kuti, Nigerian-style Afrobeat, and also the sounds of, you know, kind of American funk music. And those things, you can draw a pretty direct line, because, like, James Brown was a huge influence on Fela Kuti and on the Ethiopian musicians of the 70s. What about the line between, say, metal and the stuff that you've been known for?
It's more like, for me as a drummer, like sort of mirroring the rhythm sections of like hard rock bands like Deep Purple or Rainbow or Black Sabbath, more than, say, metal. Like, I'm never going to have a double bass rig. I'm never going to play blast beats or anything like that. It's more like, you know, when metal was just a little baby, you know, like in the 75.
Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
So the album is called Burnt Offering. It is the latest from the Budos Band. Burnt Offering is the title track of their new album, and they'll be doing a record release show on Saturday night. That's the 25th, October 25th, 8 p.m. at The Wick in Brooklyn. The band from Staten Island here in our Manhattan studio. Here's the Budos Band with a live performance of Burnt Offering. That's the Budos Band live in the Soundcheck studio with the title track from their new album called Burnt Offering. Here on Soundcheck, Tom Brennick on guitar, Dan Fodor on bass, Michael Deller playing the Farfisa organ, Andrew Green on trumpet, Jared Tankel on baritone sax, Brian Porfilio behind the drum kit. It seems like, you know, every other day here in the Soundcheck studio, we have another band from Brooklyn. Do you guys feel like you're flying the flag for Staten Island somehow?
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, most of us at one point in our lives lived in Staten Island or still live there now. And it's, you know, it's where we practice. It's where we hang out, for, you know, and it's home for me and for some of the other guys in the band. So it's Brooklyn is cool and everything, and it's nice to go and hang out, but Staten Island's where we are really from.
All right. And it has been the home base for the Budos Band for the course of a number of years now, during which time the band has released several records and built up a kind of a reputation, Jared, for, shall I say, a high-energy performance style. Very often full of words that I would not want you to actually say on the radio.
Yeah, luckily the FCC does not look after musical venues. That's not in their purview. But we do like to, we like to get a little rowdy. We like to get people excited at our shows. You know, that's definitely something that has grown over time, and we've grown into that a little bit as a personality of our band. Just, you know. We like to party, so everybody else should too. You know, that's sort of the mentality.
Well, and, you know, longtime Budos Band listeners will be happy to know that the new album, for all the kind of change in direction, still has that kind of hard partying sound.
Yeah, I mean, we were striving for that more than ever in making this record. You know, I think if you went to see a Budos Band show, like if you were to go to our record release party on October 25th at the WIC, and then you put on the Budos Band.
What time is that, Jared? Is that 8 p.m.?
No, it's probably going to be a little bit later, John. I'm thinking 10, 10:30, something like that. But, you know, and then you went on and put on Budos Band 1, you would hear, we feel like, a very different band. Mm. And so this time around, we wanted to really try to convey that energy that we have on stage on the record.
Okay. It's been great having you guys here with us in the studio today.
Sure.
You got a song to play us out with?
Yeah, I think we're going to go with Shattered Winds.
All right. The album is called Burnt Offering. It is the newest from the Budos Band. This song is called Shattered Winds. It's a final live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. Our session with the Budos Band from Staten Island on our website, soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, comedian Wyatt Cenac just released a new stand-up special called Brooklyn on Netflix this week. And to help Wyatt celebrate, we'll listen back to our conversation with him from June at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where he gave us a taste of his new material targeting Brooklyn and Brooklynites. Plus, the three Australian women who make up Little May blend folky harmony vocals with a catchy pop sensibility but with a bit of something darker and more subversive as well. They'll play live. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.